This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The early 21st century may well be remembered in the entertainment world as the birth of binge watching. Whether the habit of hitting next episode actually improves the experience is up for debate. But for one artist, it's a window into history. In an effort to explore our cultural relationship with computer technology, artist and art professor Jeff Thompson watched 20 years worth of Law and Order, a total of 456 episodes, and documented when computers were used and how.
The police who investigate crime and the district attorneys who prosecute the offenders. These are their stories.
The computer age.
They made mistakes before computers.
Mixing up a homicidal maniac and a turnstile jumper?
Bruno Walker. Sounds like Brutus Walker.
Yeah, only Brutus carries bigger guns. Here.
The project was commissioned by the arts and technology organization Rhizome, and Jeff joins us now to tell us more. Jeff, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me.
So why Law and Order?
There are so many reasons. Law and Order is this kind of perfect mirror for looking at culture. We think of TV as maybe being too artificial or fake, but Law and Order, it's ripped from the headlines format. It's meant to really kind of mirror what's happening now. And unlike a movie, which only lasts an hour and a half and has kind of a single plot point, Law and Order spans 20 years. So we have this huge kind of archive to draw on. Since it started in 1990, that's kind of the rise of the PC being really common. And throughout the 20 years of the show, we can see the PC, laptops, internet use, smartphones, those kinds of things. It's this perfect kind of period in technological history as well. Mm.
You told The Atlantic that Law and Order is the perfect artifact for exploring the history of our relationship to computers. So does this make you a sort of, digital archaeologist?
I think so, yeah. I mean, there's things that we've written a lot about, like mainframe computers, the early history of computing, or cloud computing issues now. But the more mundane things, like a computer desk, or how people would use computers together, or where they might be placed in a room, that kind of stuff we don't write about, we don't even really think about. But a TV show like Law and Order is a perfect way that we can go back in history and kind of observe those things that were included in the show without ever really being thought about. It's just reflecting how we used those at that time.
So tell us a little bit about that. How did you see the computer desk being used through 20 years of Law and Order?
So anyone who's used a computer in the 80s or 90s remembers these kind of fake wood, specialized kind of furniture. You'd buy it at a computer store, which also used to be a thing. And, you know, would have things like a keyboard tray or slots for CD-ROMs and stuff like that. So it's this very particular kind of piece of furniture that doesn't exist anymore. So in the early episodes, you see computers on these dedicated kinds of things. They're tucked away in the corner of a room. They're shared amongst an entire office, or occasionally someone has their own computer. And by the end of the show, you know, everyone's using laptops at their own desk. So things like the computer desk, you could see it vanish.
Yeah, it used to never be at the same desk where a person sat.
Right. I mean, part of the reason might be you have these huge monitors, but I think, too, that it was this kind of rude thing. You wouldn't use a computer while talking to somebody. So you see in the early parts of the show, you know, someone will maybe turn to use the computer to look something up, but really I think it would be kind of rude to be interacting with this thing. And, of course, by the end, we have the total opposite, which is people distractedly checking their phones to read their email and stuff like that.
There are, in total, 456 episodes of Law and Order. How long did it take you to watch all 20 seasons? Tell us about that process.
It took about a year and a half. Each episode is about 45 minutes long. I did watch the show at 150% speed, so about half again as fast.
Wait a minute. Can you understand what people say? Was it all sped up?
Yeah, that's about the threshold at which it's still enjoyable to watch. I mean, it drove my wife crazy hearing it in the background. But it saved me somewhere around 100 hours watching it like that.
So I guess you weren't really watching for the dialogue. You were sort of scanning for computers?
No, I mean, I was watching it, and along the way, I gathered a total of about 11,000 screenshots of computers, but also quotes about computers and technology on the show. I recorded instances of firsts, so the first laptop, that kind of thing, and sort of unrelated to computers, gathering up other information that I thought would be useful to look at, like the gender of victims and perpetrators.
So you made a kind of concordance of Law and Order.
Yeah, and one of many potential threads that someone could take through the show. I think that there's a lot left to be mined just because of the show's structure. It's kind of perfect for that.
You need tools to write a thesis?
No, I use a laptop computer to write a thesis. I use tools to fix my VCR and my toaster.
So any moments stand out for you as you're scanning through all of this material at 1.5 speed when you sort of notice, oh, a computer, great.
So there's some really interesting ones. The first computer ever appears in the first episode. So it starts from the very beginning. It's not turned on. And in fact, we see computers not turned on through a good portion of the show, especially the first half of the show. Most computers aren't. The first computer is turned on in the 9th episode of the first season. And then throughout, we see things appear like the dot matrix printer in the 2nd season, people talking about BBS systems and the word download in the 3rd season.
So like old bulletin board kind of things, yeah.
CD-ROMs appearing in the 7th season, the first BlackBerry in season 12, season 12 being about 2002. And then by the end of the show, we see Gmail pop up in the 17th season, the first thumb drive in the 2nd to last, the first iPhone in the 2nd to last.
How did these track with consumer use? I mean, were they sort of ahead of their time a little bit and pushing the use of computers, showing that, you know, the police department has it over us, or about the same time?
That's a good question. I don't know for sure. I think it's probably just a gut kind of guess. I think it's probably a little behind, which is actually probably pretty accurate. Uh-huh. I mean, it's a city institution rather than a design firm or, you know, a tech startup or something like that.
We have talked on this program about how binge watching can change the way that we consume television. It is interesting to think that it could be changing its artistic or historical value. Do you think that this experiment of yours has added value to this television show?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think I identify as an artist. I see this project as certainly falling under my studio practice. It also falls under cultural analysis, media history, other things too, which I find interesting. But as an artist, I think not knowing exactly what it is, what these screenshots mean as a whole, that's interesting to me, that I can look at them and see one kind of thing. Somebody else might look at these images having a different history with computers and might find a totally different narrative.
Jeff, you mentioned that you'd put together a list. How are you sharing this project with the public?
So the main forum is a Tumblr blog at computersonlawandorder.tumblr.com. It posts one episode a day for the next 456 days. We're about maybe 15 episodes in, so for the next year and a half. And then on there as well is a link to a GitHub repository, which has all the code used for, there's some specialized software I wrote and some hardware and things like that for gathering the screenshots, the variety of other things like that. And then there's a book that's also linked on the Tumblr, which includes an essay about the project and a list of the firsts and the quotes and a few other things.
What are some other programs or maybe even types of programs that might reveal important cultural shifts and technological shifts when viewed in this archaeological way? And, you know, Sex and the City, Jeopardy, anything else come to mind for you?
I don't know. I've been thinking about that a lot over the last few weeks. Somebody mentioned Murder, She Wrote, which I never watched, which might be interesting. I mean, even I think the spinoffs of Law and Order aren't, like SVU, are not nearly as good for this kind of thing. They have a more sci-fi sort of relationship to technology. And I don't know if that has to do with when it started or just the structure of the show. I mean, I think you could find different things in different kinds of shows depending on what you're looking for. So if you're looking for accurate representations, that's much harder. If you're looking for what we imagine technology being like, you have a lot more to choose from. Jeopardy would be really interesting. somehow analyzing every question on the show or something.
I wonder if when you're in public places now or offices, you immediately notice, you kind of case the joint for what kind of technology is around you.
It's actually so much worse than that. whenever I watch TV or a movie, I built a little device to capture the screenshots just because it made it easier. So it's sort of a touch sensor. And I now, when I'm watching TV completely unrelated, I have this sort of reflex to reach out and hit the button, and I feel it in my arm, and it's driving me crazy.
Well, Jeff Thompson, I'm sure you'll be onto something else at some point.
Absolutely.
You can read much more about Jeff's project and see links to that Tumblr, which is where he's been recording and documenting computers on Law and Order, as well as the essay he mentioned. Links are all at wordofmouthradio.org.
Type in what we're looking for, Eagle Graphics, and the motto, Our Dentis, Fortuna, Juva. Search engine does the rest. If it's anywhere on the internet, we'll get a hit.
One of these days, you have to teach me how to play solitaire on that thing.
Bingo. This shows us where to find it.
Let's surf the net.
And the continuous consumption rolls on with a man who combs through YouTube's comments section, pretty much the dreck of the internet. There's not much there except for hate speech, Obama conspiracy theories, and the occasional bit of spam on the face cream that keeps celebrities looking so young. On the Media's PJ Vogt and Alex Goldman put together this story of a writer and filmmaker who combs through the avalanche of banality for nuggets of humanity. Here it is from the TLDR blog.
Comments on the internet are incredibly bad. We all know this, and we also all know that YouTube comments are kind of the worst of the worst. There's never a reason for a human being to read them, unless you're Mark Slutsky. Mark's a writer and a filmmaker in Montreal. A while ago, he was procrastinating, and he found himself just clicking through pages and pages of the YouTube comments on pop songs. The reason he kept coming back was because occasionally, scattered in the dross, he'd find these tiny, poignant stories that really surprised him.
They just seemed so ephemeral, you know. It seemed like they could disappear at any moment. They could sort of be buried under 100 or 1,000 stupid new comments, or the video could be deleted. And I thought that somebody had to sort of save them.
So that's what Mark does. He's created this blog called Sad YouTube, where he collects the stories that he finds. In some cases, he's actually tracked down the people who posted the comments and then interviewed them about their lives. The result's really surprising. It's a document that proves that there's truth and humanity in YouTube comments. The internet's bleakest corner, the place that all of us have learned to just walk past.
People go, they're fooling around, they're like checking out old songs, and all of a sudden, an unexpected memory will just sort of ambush them. And the YouTube comment box is right there for them.
What were some that you liked?
So there's this old disco song by a French band called Voyage, and the song is called Souvenirs. Which means memories in French, which is, just appropriate. And I found this comment on it. I would like to send you a memory. I was 13, walked to the projects across the street in Manhattan. This song was played from an apartment on the 8th floor so loudly and clearly. I grabbed a kid and danced the hustle with her for maybe an hour. It felt so great to be alive and feel free to dance in the streets, parks, or a cafeteria during lunch. The boomboxes played this on the subway platform. We broke out dancing the hustle waiting for the train. The hustle was sexy and graceful. Never got tired. I love how this goes from one really beautiful moment in someone's life, you know, not a huge moment, not, you know, something you'd read about anywhere, and it sort of zooms out and talks about how this song was playing everywhere and how it was the backdrop to people's lives. And that just sort of gives me such a great sense of what it was like to be alive at that time when the song was popular.
There's a Portuguese word, saudade, which doesn't really translate to English, but it means nostalgia and melancholy, just longing for this place that you've lost. Mark is a bloodhound for that feeling. Listen to this comment he found, which was posted on the song Telephone Lines by ELO.
I remember the first time I heard this song. It was late night, early July, 77. I was in the Navy and home on leave after graduating A school with orders to a destroyer in the Western Pacific. The next morning, I was to fly from my home in Boston to California, and then from Travis Air Force Base to the Philippines. Halfway around the world, to where I didn't know a single soul. I thought of girls I knew in high school and wondered what they were doing. This song really resonated with me that night. Don't you realize the things we did, We're all for real, not a dream. You know what's interesting? That's the second mention of Travis Air Force Base in a sad YouTube comment.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the first one?
The other one is one of my favorites of all time. It's on the video for Downtown by Petula Clark.
Wait, is that like the Downtown that I'm thinking of?
Yeah. You know, when you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go. That Downtown.
Yeah.
I'll read the comment to you if you want.
Yeah, please.
High school. After lunch, some of the girls would dance on the gym floor before classes. Beth, Joellen, Nina, to name a few. The song had come out, and they just danced to it. I remember sitting and waiting for my favorite girl to come out. When she did, my heartbeat sped up till I thought I would pass out. When you're alone, she knew I was there. Life is making you lonely, you can always I heard it at Travis Air Force Base before going to Nam. I just cried while waiting to board the plane. All the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown. What I love about that one is it's a sort of double memory. He remembers these girls dancing on the gym floor. And then it's sort of this almost a cinematic cut where all of a sudden he's at Travis Air Force Base waiting to get on a plane to Vietnam, remembering that earlier memory.
Mark spent hundreds of hours just staring at these YouTube threads. He says at some point he developed this sixth sense, where he can just skim down a page and the good comments will jump out to him. But YouTube's making it a lot harder. In November, they instituted this change which very strongly encourages commenters to use their real names. It's good for everybody who wants less vitriol on the site, but it's bad for Mark because it means that some stories just aren't going to get shared.
Because some of it is just too personal. There's this really, really poignant comment on an old Herb Alpert song. Okay, so the song is called This Guy's in Love With You. You see this guy. This guy's in love with you. Last year of high school for me, 1967. Yes, my best friend and his girlfriend, who we were both in love with, though he never knew. Haven't seen her in 35 plus years. You always remember the ones who got away. Never told anybody. Their song. I can't tell we know. It's really sort of like precious memory. And the commenter's name is Wanker4761.
That's, I think, everything I love about the internet is in that. I've heard some talk.
They say. You know, I think 90% of the comments I found have been on bootleg uploads, you know, technically illegal uploads of old songs. And they're all kind of doomed. Eventually, a lawyer or you know, some sort of copyright practice will flag them and they'll get taken down and the comments just disappear with them.
I don't know. I am so on the side of saving things and saving ephemera. I feel like in your piece there's like a real sense of like loss and sadness that these things are going away faster than you can save them. But like I also understand that this is just mountains of crap also, and that like God, like if the Internet Archive or someone had to save every comment, I'd feel terrible for them because there's a lot more comments than there are views.
Well, you know, when an archaeologist wants to learn about a civilization and wants to learn about how people live day to day in that civilization, they go through the garbage. And that's what I feel like I'm doing.
You can find a link to Sad YouTube, which we think is pretty redeeming and worth a look, and much more from the TLDR blog. Links are at wordofmouthradio.org. There's more Word of Mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.